which we are speaking, they were much less formidable walls. They were rammed earth and wooden palisades. And when the nomads penetrated into China, they got over the defenses, which meant all of the military forces along the Great Wall, they were in. And the capital of Luoyang is sacked three times that we know of by so-called Xuan Nu, that is, northern barbarians. The most famous is the 311 sack, which is noted in that letter that was founded by Oral Stein out in the Tauran Basin. That does not happen in Constantinople. Even provincial cities, such as Thessalonica, the great city of Greece, was very, very well fortified and could defy nomadic invaders. And that was an advantage that the Byzantine emperors had. And then finally, the Byzantines, who have their own problems dealing with the Islamic world, which they never really fully understood, and their own religious internal issues, remarkably failed to have the same kind of impact on the steppe peoples of the Western Eurasian steppes, on the Pontic-Caspian steppes, that the Chinese and, as we shall see, the Muslim world had on steppe nomads. It's a curious fact that the nomadic peoples dwelling on the steppes from the Danube to the Caspian really never embraced Orthodox Christianity. Orthodox Christianity made very, very few inroads. When the Mongol army of Batu appears on the western steppes for the great Mongol conquest, starting in really in 1236, 1237, the vast numbers of Turkic peoples there, Kipchak Turks, Kumans, they're still worshiping their ancient ancestral gods, heaven, Tangri, as he would be known in Turkish. They followed their shamans. They had acquired some of the material culture of Byzantium, but a lot more of the Islamic world. And really, these regions will convert to Islam in the 13th and 14th centuries with very little reference to Constantinople. And we'll be investigating why that is so in the coming lectures. That is, Orthodox Christianity never really scored a major triumph in culturally and religiously assimilating the Eurasian steppes. Their triumph would be the Russians, the Rus, the Scandinavian Slavic peoples of the forest, and that would have major consequences for the steppes, but we shall reserve that issue for later on. Well, let's take a look at how Byzantine emperors were dealing with nomadic powers contemporary with those faced by the Tang emperors of China. And actually, the story will go a bit later into the so-called Sung dynasty. First, the Byzantines found that they were in a real quandary when these Turks showed up. The first time the Byzantines get a firsthand look at the Turks is in the reign of the Emperor Justinian, the great emperor who ruled from 527 to 565, who attempted to reconquer the western provinces, when envoys come from the Avars. These are clearly members of the inner tribes of the Avars, of the Avar Khan, who had been driven west by Bumin in the Turks when they had overthrown the Avar Khanate in 552. The envoys arrived, and they're clearly dressed with these long braids. Their appearance excited comment, their leather breeches, their bows. They were seen as a new and an exotic nomadic people, quite beyond anything what the people in Constantinople had seen. And the Avars wanted to enter into an alliance with the Byzantine emperors for good reason. The Gurk Turks claimed that these Avars were wayward vassals and belonged to their authority. And this opened up a series of negotiations between the court in Constantinople with the rulers of the Western Gurk Turks. That would be Istemi, the brother of Bumin, who first ruled over the Western tribes, and then later Tardush. He is the fellow who makes the comment about the 10 tongues and the one lie of the Byzantine envoys. And one of the big stumbling blocks in these negotiations is the question of the Avars. The Byzantine court, the imperial court, hoped to use the Avars as possible allies. They accepted the Avars into alliance, whereas the Gurk Turks wanted those Avars under their authority. Another issue that was raised between the Byzantine court and these Turks on the steppes were trade routes. And we get some of the first detailed information from contemporary Byzantine sources particularly a man named Menander the Protector, who records a number of these missions, that the Byzantines, starting in the reign of Mad Emperor Justin II, the nephew of Justinian, entered into negotiations in order to obtain access to what is clearly an extension of the Silk Road that is coming from the cities of Khorasan, that is on the southern shores of the Aral Sea, that is receiving silk from Kashgar, that is making its way across the steppes to the ports on the Black Sea. One of the most important ports was the city of Sherzan, which was a Byzantine possession. It's in the Russian Crimea today, and it's a Greek-speaking city. And there is where a lot of the diplomatic activity took place, and immense profits were made because the Byzantines could obtain Chinese silks and other exotic goods. Now, since 555, the Byzantines had begun to set up their own silk manufacture. They had obtained the secret. Nonetheless, there was never enough silk in Constantinople to satisfy the demand for trades, for the upper class, and there was always a desire for imports. So this was another feature, that is, the Byzantines wanted access to those trade routes terminating on the Black Sea. And they will deal with the Gurk Turks, later with the Khazars, later with the Pecheneks and the Cumans. This is a constant issue that is raised between the imperial government and the nomadic tribes of the steppes. Meanwhile, the Avars turned out to be not the best of allies. To escape the control of the Gurk Turks, they moved west, following the routes that many nomadic peoples had taken, and they end up settling on the Hungarian plain. We only know of one Avar Khan in Western Europe, and his name is Behram. He ruled at the end of the 6th century and into the early 7th century AD, and usually the Byzantine sources simply refer to the Avar Khan. They don't even designate him by name. The Avars settled on the Pannonian Plain, the same area that Attila had controlled. They had escaped the power of the Western Turkish Khans, who were ruling over the Pontic-Caspian steppes and points east, and there they began to raid into the Byzantine Empire. The reason for that was the Avar Khan, just like all nomadic rulers, needed gold. He needed wealth to pay off his various followers. And in addition, the Avars found that the imperial frontiers along the Danube were particularly vulnerable, that the imperial government had commitments elsewhere, that they had exhausted themselves by waging wars of reconquest in Italy and North Africa. And in the late 6th century, the Avars followed the river systems of the Balkans, usually following the Middle Danube down to the Moravia River, the Margos River, and entered into the Balkans and ravaged many of the same cities once ravaged by the Huns. The imperial government responded in part with diplomacy and gifts. There's a famous story that the Emperor Maurice Tiberius actually sent an elephant and a gold couch to the Avar Khan as novelties to try to convince them that an alliance would be better. Didn't really work. It backfires. It's the usual problem that if you give too many good gifts to the nomads, they might think, well, we could actually get more if this is what they're willing to give us. Perhaps a little pressure will gain us even more. The Chinese make the same comment in their diplomatic text. Furthermore, Maurice Tiberius, who ruled from 582 to 602, is also credited with writing a strategic manual, the Strategikon, in which he comes up with the same military recommendations that Li Jin, a generation later, would do for the Tang Emperor. That is, how to cope with nomadic cavalry. It's an extremely instructive document. It also reveals that the Byzantines are now mounting cavalry with metal stirrups, that they've adopted some of the cavalry tactics of the steppes, and they are hiring nomadic horse archers just as Tang emperors did. What is restricting the Byzantines in dealing with the nomadic invaders is the fact that they are at war with Persia, the Sassanid Shahs. These wars drag out over the 6th and 7th century AD. One erupts in 568 in negotiations when the Emperor Justin goes mad and doesn't accept certain treaty obligations. By 572, the two empires are at war. This rages down to 590, 591. Another war breaks out and rages from 602 to 628. And really, in the last 100 years of the Persian and Byzantine emperors, almost 90 years of it are in constant warfare over Armenia, Syria, and the traditional battlefields of the Middle East. And Maurice Tiberius is restricted in what he can do vis-a-vis the Avars. In 590, he lucks out. There's a civil war in Persia. The legitimate emperor Khusru II is overthrown by one of his generals. He goes to Constantinople, and Maurice Tiberius, lends him a Roman army, which puts Khusru back on the throne in 591. That buys the Byzantine Empire a brief respite from Persian wars, and with it, Maurice goes after the Avars. He blunders in trying to have his army winter on the steppes of Eastern Russia, Eastern Europe. They rebel in 602. They murder Maurice, put a man by the name of Phocas on the throne, who turns out to be an incompetent. The Persian Shah invades, first as an act of vengeance for his old patron, Maurice Tiberius. And then he realizes the Byzantine Empire is such a shambles, why not conquer it? And so the Persian Shah Khusro II, between 602 and 626, comes very close to overthrowing the Byzantine Empire in Asia. Well, the Avars now see their chance. They enter into an alliance with the Sassanid Shah, and in 626, the Avars besiege Constantinople on the European side, and a Persian army is on the Asian side attempting to cross and capture New Rome. Well, this alliance of nomads with the Shah of Iran fails, largely due to the brilliant campaigns of the Emperor Heraclius, who, while his capital is besieged by Avars and Persians, takes the imperial army, moves it by sea into Armenia, and hooks up with the Gurk Turks. And they together wage a war against the Sassanid Empire that ends in total Byzantine victory by 628. The Byzantine victory over the Persians, story well known in Byzantine history, had resulted in the Byzantine and Persian empires fighting themselves to exhaustion. But it was also a Turkish victory. The Turks, the Western Turks at this point, who were essentially operating as independent Khans, and are the future ancestors of probably of the Khazars, who are in the next lecture. They had entered into alliance with Heraclius. They had provided cavalry. They had also put pressure on the Persians. And by the time the war is over in 628, it is not only the Byzantine Empire that has prospered. Heraclius recovers all of his Asian provinces in Egypt. The Turks now occupy the strategic passes of the Caucasus and Transoxiana. And the Persian Empire has been reduced to its Iranian core. It is fiscally bankrupt and becomes very, very vulnerable to Arab attack, and in 639 AD will come crashing down. Now, the Byzantine victory over the Persians ends up being a sort of poison legacy because the Byzantine Empire loses its most wealthy provinces in Syria, Egypt, and North Africa to the Arab armies under the banner of Islam. And that becomes an issue that we deal with in later lectures about the caliphate. On the other hand, the Byzantine state does reconfigure itself as a regional power based on Asia Minor, the Balkans, and Italy. And there, the Byzantines have to deal with nomadic peoples. In fact, the nomadic peoples emerge as a major threat, a potential threat to the Byzantine state. The Byzantine emperor can always come to terms with the caliph. And very quickly, after the initial Muslim conquest, Constantinople is able to stabilize its frontiers and come to an understanding with the caliphate. But the nomadic peoples are another matter. The Avars, for instance, sometimes allies, sometimes raiders, they dominated the steppes of Eastern Europe, the Hungarian plain, the Wallachian plain. They repeatedly invaded the Balkans and disrupted the imperial control of the Balkans, one of their heartlands. They also had come to an agreement early on with a group of people known as the Lombard, Germanic peoples dwelling in Hungary, back in 567 to wipe out a common foe, the Gepidae, and then the Lombards, having common sense, crossed the Alps and invaded Italy, and those Germanic peoples shattered Byzantine control of Italy. And so the Avars personally, directly, were responsible for disrupting two of the three imperial heartlands, Italy and the Balkans. Now, they themselves didn't settle. They sent the Lombards into Italy, and the Avars, who were nomadic peoples, attacked the Balkans, disrupted imperial communications, sacked cities, destroyed the road networks, and Slavic peoples moved in and settled in the Balkans. And that results in the great ethnic transformation of the Balkans from Latin and Greek-speaking provinces into the Slavic principalities and kingdoms of the later Middle Ages. And the Slavs, technically, were subjects of the Avar Khan. They were agriculturalists. They were organized by clan and family. They were the ideal subjects for a nomadic conqueror because they lacked cohesion. They were easily taxed. They were easily directed. They provided the infantry to support the raids of the Avar attacks. Now, the Byzantine government had its own difficulties. Part of it was an internal dispute over the images. They were essentially waging a civil war among themselves between 726 and 843. And the Avars had suffered a significant check when they failed to take the city of Constantinople in 626. And the result was Avar power receded. In the course of the 7th and 8th century, the Avars refocused their attacks on Western Europe. And those attacks drew the Avars to the attention of the Franks, who reunited Western Europe into the first effective Western European state, especially under the Emperor Charlemagne from 768 to 814. And Charlemagne eventually broke the power of the Avars, capturing their main settlement, the so-called Six Rings, that is the six fortresses of the Avars, we suspect in the vicinity of Budapest, and ended Avar power by 796. The Avars, however, had left a powerful legacy. They had shown how a steppe nomadic conqueror could, if he wished, mobilize the power of the Slavic tribes, challenge Constantinople, and extort numbers of gifts, and either in tribute or in plunder. The finds that have come to light in Hungary bear a testimony to the success of this policy. Marvelous items have been found in Hungarian tombs dated to the Avar period, all sorts of objects that originated from the Byzantine world that had arrived in trade, in tribute, and plunder to the Avar Khans in the course of the 7th and 8th centuries. The successors to the Avar policy were a group of people called the Bulgars. Now, they are in part the ancestors of the modern Bulgarians, but the Bulgars were a Turkic people. They were apparently a Turkish tribe that had migrated west to escape the power of the great Khans of the Western Turks, who eventually would reinvent themselves as the Khazar Khans. And in 681, these Bulgars crossed the Danube into imperial territory and were initially admitted as imperial federates or allies. The relationship between the Bulgars and the Byzantine Empire is a major feature of the 9th and early 10th centuries. Up until 864, when the Khan Boris converted to Orthodox Christianity and began to build cities and rule as a Byzantine-style monarch, the rulers of the Bulgars were essentially nomadic Khans ruling in the Balkans and the Eastern European steppes. With that power of Slavic infantry and nomadic cavalry, they repeatedly attacked the Byzantine Empire when it was at its weakest. It was waging essentially a civil war over the use of images. And Bulgar Khans inflicted embarrassing defeats on imperial armies. The most famous one is in 811, when the Khan Krum bushwhacked the army of the Emperor Nicephorus I, destroyed the army, killed the emperor. The emperor was actually captured and executed, and turned the emperor's skull into a drinking goblet. This is a common feature of nomadic warriors. I've mentioned it in tandem with the Scythians, who took heads and scalp. There are stories of the Xuang Nu doing the same, even stories of the Scythians, the King Cyrus of Persia, his head gets detached from his body by Queen Tomaris of the Massagetae, and she uses it as some kind of a symbol of victory. These defeats forced the Byzantine state especially the Byzantine Emperor Leo V, to acknowledge that most of the Balkans had passed under the authority of the Bulgar Khan, and that imperial power in the Balkans was restricted to the cities on the shore in Greece and to the peninsula of Asia Minor and the immediate hinterland of Constantinople. The Bulgar Khan ruled as a virtual equal vis-a-vis the Emperor of Constantinople. It is only in 864 that the situation improves for the Byzantines. In that year, Khan Boris decided to convert to Christianity. He toyed with Catholic Christianity, but he eventually went with the Orthodox version of it, in part because two brothers, St. Cyril and Methodius, had devised a Slavic alphabet. It's known as the Cyrillic alphabet. And they had begun to translate the Christian scriptures and Bible into a language known as Old Church Slavonic, and that would have been a Slavic dialect understood by many of the subjects of the Bulgar Khan. Furthermore, Christianity offered organization. It offered hierarchy. And as a result, Khan Boris, who became Tsar Boris upon the conversion, could start to bring about the organization of a Byzantine-style kingdom, collect taxes, establish cities, and really start a major economic recovery in the Balkans. And in the process, the Bulgars became Bulgarians. That is, the Turkic ruling class was assimilated into the wider Slavic population and essentially became Orthodox Bulgarians henceforth, speaking a Slavic language. Now, the second son of Tsar Boris got it into his head, because he studied at the University of Constantinople, that he could become emperor. And he waged two major wars, one raging from 894 to 897, another one breaking out in 911 and ending in 924, in an attempt to pressure Constantinople in giving him an imperial marriage. This failed. And in the end, it so weakened the incipient Bulgarian kingdom that it was later incorporated back into the Byzantine Empire. That would be accomplished by the emperors John I and Basil II later in the 10th century. And so the nomadic component of that Bulgar Khanate essentially passes. The Byzantines, in their experience with the Bulgars and Avars, perhaps might have drawn some incorrect lessons. The Avars and Bulgars both were regional powers. They were not a great confederacy. They came into contact with Constantinople right off the steppes. Both of them were scions of the great Western Turkish Khanate, or the Gurk Turk Khanate. They were impressed by Byzantine civilization. Now, the Franks eliminated the Avars from concern. The Bulgars, however, had been converted and ultimately assimilated. And I think Constantinople might have drawn some incorrect lessons here. They might have believed that future nomadic peoples who offered threats to the security of Constantinople could likewise be converted to Orthodox Christianity, turned into potential subjects of the Emperor of Constantinople. And this will have fateful consequences when the Byzantines deal with new nomadic peoples on the steppes, particularly the Khazars, later Pechenegs and Cumans, and then Seljuk Turks, that is, Turks of Central Asia, who will enter Asia Minor. And the Byzantines always thought that somehow they could convert the Seljuk Turks, that somehow Byzantine civilization and Orthodox Christianity would prevail. But what the Byzantines didn't take into account, the Bulgars were a small minority ruling a Slavic population, and these Turks had not come under the power of Islam. And the Turks will embrace Islam, and in so doing, will define themselves ethnically into a very, very distinct population and a power, a people who can assimilate rather than who are going to be converted. And the Byzantines were not aware of this process, and we will see how it takes place in one of the upcoming lectures about Islam and the Turks.
Lecture 17, Khazar Khans.
In this lecture, I want to introduce a new nomadic peoples known as the Khazars, sometimes pronounced Khazars. The Khans of the Khazars ruled as members of the Ashina family. This is a family that claimed descent from the original Khan, Bumin, who overthrew the Avars back in 552 AD. And a number of different Khans on the western and central Eurasian steppes in the early medieval period claimed some kind of connection. That gave them a sort of legitimacy. It was often associated with the favor of the sky god Tengri, who is essentially cast as the benevolent protective god, similar to the mandate of heaven in Chinese ideology. The Khazars are significant for several reasons. One of them is the controversy that they have stirred up because they, at least the upper classes, the Khan, his family, and his Bek, or leading commander, warlord, a Khazar version of the later Turkish word Bey, converted to Judaism sometime at the end of the 8th or beginning of the 9th century. Furthermore, they play a very important role in Byzantine foreign policy and come to play a decisive role in the Byzantine wars against the Arab Caliphate. So who are these people? Why do they occupy this peculiarly important role in Byzantine history? And again, we'll be examining that question I raised in the previous lecture. Why did they not convert to Orthodox Christianity? Why did they go over to Judaism? And why did the Byzantines, for all of their dealings with these people in the 7th, 8th, and 9th centuries, fail to win the Khazars over to what many historians call the Byzantine Commonwealth? That is, the conversion of various peoples of Eastern Europe to Orthodox Christianity, which then becomes the basis of Eastern Europe today. Well, the Khazars were Western Turks, Gurk Turks, and undoubtedly their ancestors were among those Turks who had concluded an alliance with the Emperor Heraclius back in 625, 626 to make common cause against the Sassanid Emperor. The ruler at that time was a man named Tong Yabgu. Yabgu Khan would be his official title. That means subordinate Khan. He recognized as his superior the Khans ruling out in the east near the borders of China. And their agreement was to take on the armies of Sassanid Persia, then ruled by Khusru II, the emperor, the Persian Shah, with ambitions of conquering Constantinople. As a result, large numbers of Turkish cavalry were released for imperial service. We know in 627, 628, some 10,000 Turkish horsemen crossed over the Caucasus and invaded Iran, ravaging the regions of Azerbaijan, penetrating as far south as the modern city of Hamadan, and causing great distress to the Sassanid Emperor. Other of the subjects of the Khan passed into Byzantine service. And starting with the Emperor Heraclius, who again ruled from 610 to 641, during these wars with the Persians, the imperial army comes to field regular units of Turkish horse archers as part of the strike force, the field army, used in major operations. As I mentioned in a previous lecture in passing, this